I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We have with us in our studios here Ed Offley, and he's written a book that really grabbed my attention. It's called Turning the Tide, How a Small Band of Allied Sailors Defeated the U-Boats and Won the Battle of the Atlantic. And Ed Offley's previous book was Scorpion Down, which is a really amazing book. He's a Vietnam vet, graduated from the University of Virginia, and lives in Panama City, which is not a bad place to live. And Ed, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark. Glad to be here.
So, I mean, you know, when you look at World War II, and as you write later on in your book, there were several events in World War II that were really pivotal, like the Russian front and the Allied invasion of Sicily, taking of Sicily, as you write about. But the Battle of the Atlantic is what you're writing about, which was the other major event. But, you know, we always hear these stories about U-boats and, you know, merchant ships being blown up in the Atlantic. But whenever you hear about World War II, it's always about D-Day and Normandy or Saipan and Iwo Jima and the bomb in Japan, not the Battle of the Atlantic.
There's a very, very, to me, a very explainable reason why the Battle of the Atlantic remains kind of so hard to get a grasp on, and that's because it was everywhere for the entire duration of World War II, but at the same time, it was out at sea on water. There were very few land areas that were totally germane to it. The thing that astounded me when I started to do my own research into it, I only had a very vague idea, like anyone, was that...
Well, you were a Navy man to start with. You were in the Navy during the Vietnam War, right?
Yes. Yeah, the Navy in its wisdom entrusted me with nothing more sophisticated than a typewriter. But the Battle of the Atlantic essentially was so vast and so widespread and so long in duration that it created a kind of a contradiction, because the individual convoy fights that occurred within this battle were shockingly intimate and small in size compared with, say, the Battle of Midway. And here's an example.
Sure.
In the Battle of Midway, that's where we turned the Japanese Navy around. They lost a strategic balance in the Pacific. That lasted for 4 days, and it involved over 300 warships on both sides, 52,000 Japanese sailors, and a smaller group of about 20,000 American sailors. But that's the biggest battle in the Pacific as far as most historians are concerned. The key convoy fight, which turned the tide in the Battle of the Atlantic, took place over about a 10-day period, but there were only about 2,000 sailors on either side, 2,000 U-boat men and about 41 U-boats, and 2,000 British and American and French sailors on the other. That amount of sailors would not even have filled one cruiser in the Battle of the Atlantic. But the strategic result of the convoy fight, which was called the ONS-5, Outbound North Slow 5, that was the name of the convoy, that won the Battle of the Atlantic. And in doing so, it did for the Allies against Germany what Midway did against Japan. It stopped them dead and made the rest of the war possible.
And go ahead. Were you about to say something?
Yeah. One person I read, and it was such a great line that I sort of filed off the serial numbers, said something like this. Except for old yellowing photographs and carbon paper and jerky movie footage, nothing is left of this battle but the shape of the modern world. If we had not won the Battle of the Atlantic, Admiral Dönitz and the German Navy would have strangled the British economy. There would have been probably either a sullen neutrality or England would have just gotten out of the war. There would have been no Normandy invasion, no D-Day, no defeat of the German army on the plains of Europe. If that had happened, odds are probably pretty strong that Stalin would have just thrown in the towel himself and declared a separate peace, which means Hitler would have kept all of the countries he had occupied, which means if you don't get defeated, you win. So this watery battlefield that took place out in the North Atlantic was the turning point, not just in that battle, but in the entire war against Nazi Germany. And it was carried out by a relatively tiny group of Allied sailors and airmen.
You begin the book, and this quote, I think, says how it begins. Let's just talk a bit and go backwards a bit here. You begin the book with this quote from Winston Churchill. And the quote is, "The Battle of the Atlantic was the dominating factor all through the war. Never for one moment could we forget that everything happening elsewhere, on land, at sea, or in the air, depended ultimately on its outcome. And amid all other cares, we viewed its charging fortunes day by day with hope or apprehension." I mean, the idea that this vast Atlantic Ocean, that the merchant seamen steamed across, taking what they, the weapons and goods to England, to Britain, and back to America, that was a supply line. And if that hadn't been secured, everything would have been lost.
Well, at one point during the height of the crisis of spring of 43, it was estimated that if the convoys got routed and the shipment stopped, the United Kingdom would have run out of food in about 3 or 4 months. I mean, they were like as in nothing on any shelf. The thing that's ironic about this, in retrospect, we realize this, and people like Churchill knew it. On the other hand, the Battle of the Atlantic, to many people in the United States military and even some in the British, saw the Battle of the Atlantic as not as important as some other things they wanted to do. And as a result, there was some very poor planning. There were some incredible mistakes and to me, almost criminal negligence among some of the American admirals whose names we still salute for having ultimately won the war. But it was a very sloppily run operation from our side.
I mean, as a matter of fact, when this war started, when America got into this war in the early 40s, the Germans had the upper hand. The Germans had the upper hand in the Atlantic.
Well, they did because what's the old joke? You can't win the game unless your team goes out on the field. I want to talk to you about the real Pearl Harbor, which happened not in Hawaii, but off the Atlantic seaboard, including that of Maryland. For years, historians were always puzzled over the fact that the United States Atlantic Fleet actually got into the shooting war with the U-boats 4 months before Pearl Harbor. That this was the policy decision was classified, but then within a few weeks we started having combat incidents leading up to the most famous one, the Reuben James, which was torpedoed by U-552 and two-thirds of the crew killed instantly. The guy running that covert war was an admiral named Ernest King, who a week after Pearl Harbor became the chief of naval operations. So he not only was aware of the U-boats and the problems at hand, he was running a covert military campaign in conjunction with the British that would involve shooting at U-boats. Well, 3 weeks after Pearl Harbor, six U-boats showed up off the East Coast in what was called Operation Drumbeat. Now, this takes part outside of the chronology of my book, but it's a very profound precursor event. And what they found was no American destroyers or other warships, no patrol planes, city lights lit up like Memorial Day this weekend, total peacetime atmosphere, no convoying along the eastern coast. One of the captains had visited New York Harbor as a midshipman in the 30s on a German cruiser. And he said at one point he was sorely tempted just to steam right up the Hudson River and dock at Lower Manhattan and take his crew ashore for a beer, because he said he was convinced nobody would have noticed. But instead he followed his orders and started shooting torpedoes at ships left and right. That got the attention of the Americans, but they still had no destroyers, no escort ships, no convoys, no aerial patrols, no trained air crews. And the result was, in the first 6 months of 1942, which is the setting for my book, Turning the Tide, was a maritime slaughter that was 10 times as devastating to our war effort than the warships sunk at Pearl Harbor. Doinitz was able to sink over 600 merchant ships traveling in coastal waters while losing just a handful of U-boats.
And U-boats, we keep talking about U-boats, which have a lot of people who don't look at World War II anymore because it's like ancient history. We're talking about the German submarine fleet.
Yes.
Doinitz being the admiral in charge of that fleet. And these U-boats were on our coast during World War II. I mean, they were to the mouth of the Chesapeake and the Delaware.
They got a friend of mine who I met in the 80s by correspondence, who was one of the – he was a rarity. He was a U-boat commander who survived World War II. His name was Horst Degen. He actually got inside Chesapeake Bay. In fact, he got to right where the tourists going to the Eastern Shore use the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel, and he dropped a minefield there, got back out again. 2 days later, sank about two-thirds of a convoy that came in. It was incredible. The lack of defense and the lack of preparation was even made more scandalous to me by the fact that in 1986, a historian who I greatly admire, Michael Gannon, found a document that if the word Pearl Harbor had been on it instead of German U-boats, it would have caused Roosevelt to have been lined up and shot. 3 days before that attack wave began, in mid-January of 42, the British decoded the operational message from Admiral Dönitz to those five or six U-boats. And because of that, they were able to send a telegram to Ernest King, the admiral in charge of our Navy, saying, warning, five U-boats will be off the coast of the United States in latitude X, longitude Y, 48 hours from now. You better do something about it. And they did nothing. And you go through the record today, the archive, to look for any reason, and you won't find one because some staff member or members toward the end of the war very carefully, obviously, cleaned out the file of any directly in, culpable evidence.
But we don't even know if Roosevelt really knew about it, though.
Well, what we know is they were told, and nothing happened.
Right.
That connects two dots to me.
Okay, but maybe, but there's no like smoking gun about
that telegram. That was a smoking howitzer.
So this battle in the Atlantic. I mean, one of the things that there's so many components to this, and I the sense I got reading the book about how this war was almost literally lost. Before we get to that point, how powerful that was the amount of dead in this war, in this Battle of the Atlantic, that, I mean, that mainly took place during the whole war, but then the biggest battles were in the spring of 43, which we'll talk about in a minute. But that, which I have this right, 40,000 German sailors, 30,000 of whom lost their lives in this war?
Roughly. It was about that, yeah.
That's huge. I mean, you said this is, and then there was a merchant marine who lost their lives in this war.
Well, one of the people who was one of my favorite characters in the book was a British merchant sailor named Dean Wynne. He's passed for some time now, but he wrote a self-published memoir, and I was able to find his son and his widow and get some information. He decided to join the British merchant fleet, is what they called it, because he thought it would be safer than being in the Royal Navy or in the British Army in Africa. Well, it turns out you were three times more likely to get killed as a merchant sailor flying the British flag than in the British Army. And the same applied for the American merchant marine fleet. Their fatality rate was almost 1.5 times out of the U.S. Marine Corps. And the reason was, I'm not good at math, but you figure the Marines landed on, I think they made 6 beach invasions. So your chances were 1 out of maybe 10 that you would be in a couple of those. And the rest of the time you're somewhere else. But if you were a merchant sailor in the Atlantic, you were essentially one of the little ducks in the shooting gallery. You know, you go by this time and nothing happens. You go by that time and nothing happens. But the third or fourth time you find yourself treading water. And that happened to Dean Wynne. His luck ran out during one of the critical battles of March 43. He had seen everything, as he wrote in his thing. He had seen ships right next to his blowing up and sinking. He had seen lifeboats bobbing in the water. He had been stoking coal below the water line, and he could feel the concussion booms as the shockwaves from other torpedoes crashed into other ships. And he thought he was ready for the sheer terror of having a ship sink out from under you. But one night March 1743.
Right. March 1743.
I'm sorry.
Yes, I'm sorry. March 1743. That piece, that part of the book was really grabbed me. I mean, it was this British sailor on this boat who, as you write in here, was going to leave the sea but stayed in the sea and did stuff after the war, remained on the water. But when you describe this thing that when he went to bed thinking the seas were running a bit high from previous storms, all seemed quiet and peaceful, and he was sure that the Germans were not going to attack. But then he was jerked out of his sleep. And that piece that you write in there, to me, is the way you could describe, because these interviews you did with the men who were still alive, what they actually lived through, was to me chilling. I mean, that whole story about how he survived and how he got off the boat and how he went back down and to get the ring that he had gotten for his wife in New York.
And, well, I'm just retelling, hopefully to get up close to the terror that I felt when I read his actual homemade account. Another thing that I decided to do a little of my own research into, because I never could find a broad-based statistic, was, you know, what killed you in the Battle of the Atlantic? You know, these German torpedoes are pretty powerful explosives, and a good U-boat commander would usually hit a ship with two of them that would split the hull open immediately, and you get a lot of explosion, blast fire. Well, there was this one critical convoy fight involving two separate formations that actually were so close together that they counted as one big battle. And this happened between March 16 and 20 in 1943. Three German wolf packs were able to ambush these convoys and sank 21 ships in them. And the sinkings killed 386 sailors and passengers and naval gunners. Now, here's what I did. There's some great archives that exist where you can go, and they've posted the statistics from each of these battles as were compiled by the British and the American Navy. For this convoy fight, this was Halifax 229 and Slow Convoy 122, eastbound to England with a whole bunch of cargo. Those 21 ships went down. 386 people died. And I went back and did a compilation. And for 200 of them, there was no specific assessment of how each person or people died, because the ship vanished and nobody even saw it, or it went down so fast. But there were 180 deaths that were given causes. And of them, 30 people died when the torpedo hit. You know, the bulkhead hit them in the head, the fire burned them, the explosion killed them. The rest of them drowned or died of exposure. So the mechanism of violence in the Battle of the Atlantic was put a hole in the ship and the North Atlantic will take care of the rest. And for the U-boats, it was the same. I mean, you open a U-boat hull up when it's submerged, that's instantaneous. But there were many fights where the U-boat actually made it to the surface. The thing was sinking or was being scuttled, and all they had were little life jackets. They jump overboard, and 3 hours later, they're all dead from exposure because it was very, very cold.
I think the way you describe this, I don't know if you want to read any of it to give people a sense of what they're getting. I mean, because that to me is the heart of the book. Is it's a great military story, but it's the story of the men who were on these boats, and what they lived through. I mean, I think we had no notion about early in the book. Is it Martin Blesheim,
yes,
the German U-boat radio man. And describing what it's like living inside a U-boat. Because we have these World War II movies where everybody is crisp and clean in their uniforms. And
I grew up on,
you know,
that.
And put the periscope up and look for the ship and then take it down. But the reality was they lived like animals in a hole.
Oh, that's giving animals too much credit. I had the great honor of meeting Admiral Edward Beach, who wrote Run Silent, Run Deep. And I saw that movie as a kid. I thought, wow, that's exciting. And it shows, I guess it was Burt Lancaster and I forget the other guy. And they're 30 days out on patrol. And they still have starched shirts and ties on. What I found out from my U-boat guys is on the third day, the food was inedible. The food was good for 2 days, and then it was rotten. They had to suck lemons like the 1,700 sailors to keep from getting scurvy. A great Englishman I got to interview, Robert Atkinson, was on one of these little corvettes. And this was like a U-boat without a roof. I mean, they were up on the surface, but they had the same appalling conditions. He said half of his crew came down with tuberculosis. It was a very, very incredibly bad place to have a war.
They had one cup of water a day and had to choose between brushing their teeth, brushing their teeth, and drinking a cup of water.
Yeah, we're just talking about the mild scenarios here. There's some that I don't even want to talk about.
Toilets that if you push the wrong button, instead of going down, it will come up on you.
Well, I don't know if it made it into the book, but Beschheim was on a previous U-boat called U-67, and the captain got so fed up that they were, you know, tiptoeing beneath the surface trying to evade a group of escorts that were trying to sink them. And this one sailor had to go to the can, so he went into the bathroom, did his thing, and then there's a bunch of valves and levers, and he did the wrong thing, and it made a really loud goosh. And the captain was terrified that the sonar operators would hear it and come sink the boat. So he issued an order that whenever we're underwater on combat conditions, nobody can use the bathroom. And it was almost the first mutiny of a U-boat crew. Didn't happen, but
I mean the going back to the power of this. I mean that when you think about what happened here. I mean, I was thinking about in the book. Let me try to find this passage in the book here, because certain things kind of turned the tide a little bit. It seemed to me that when the Americans, the Allies, lost this, as you write, you can explain what this means. HX-229 and SC-122. When that battle took place and this major defeat for the Allies, I mean, it could have. This is when things began to really shift. Because the Americans and the British could have lost this if they had lost this Battle of the Atlantic. As you said earlier, there would not have been an invasion of Normandy. D-Day wouldn't have happened. The Nazis could have remained in power in Europe. Anything it was that pivotal, this thing that we don't even think about.
And maybe it was, you know, maybe it wasn't immediately obvious. One guy whose book I read said, you know, people at Little Round Top at Gettysburg – after the 20th Maine had driven the rebels back down the hill slope, they probably weren't aware that that was the turning point of the Civil War. I mean, people acknowledged that it probably was. But at the time, it was just they were lucky to survive and fight another day. And I'm sure most of the participants in what was the turning point, this 12-week period in which three or four major battles occurred, were probably more just too busy celebrating the fact that they'd seen one more sunrise. Than to think of any grand historical, this is the turning point in history. I think when you're actually in the turning point, you can't see it, at least not for a while.
No, but I mean the fact that even when we look back at the history of our wars and that America has fought, has been part of, the world has been part of, that we focus on kind of the glory where my father was of D-Day and World War II and the Battle of the Bulge and those things we always write about, or you focus on the Marines slogging through the islands as the HBO series did in the Pacific. But these things we don't think about because it's the Navy. You don't think of the Navy as really in battle. You know what I'm saying? You don't think about the Navy and people on the sea as really being in combat the same way. So you don't think about this as being a pivotal powerful pivot point in the course of the war.
Well, and there was a thing that reinforced that lack of emphasis, and that is the Navy, by very nature of its mission and technology, is a lot more sensitive to security than some of the other services, perhaps. Ernest King himself had a motto in terms of information during World War II. He said, tell them nothing, then tell them who won. He was not known as somebody who glad-handed the press. In fact, it's a little off the mark, but it's apropos of Admiral King. The Battle of Midway was won through code breaking.
Back in the Pacific now, right.
Yeah, we're back in the Pacific. The Battle of the Atlantic in great part, not the only factor, but in great part, was won by code breaking. Because you break the guy's codes, you can predict where he's going to be. You can set up the ambush. That's what happened to Nagumo at Midway. Well, anyway, this reporter on the one of the carriers, or actually another ship, befriended an officer who told him, you know, he'd be very vague about this, but, you know, we knew the Japanese were coming and we knew what ships they had. And he promptly wrote a story that somehow got around the censors that said the U.S. Navy knew the Japanese were coming and knew how many ships they had. At the time, the headlines are saying U.S. Army defeats Japanese fleet at Midway because the Navy wasn't saying anything and the Army was saying, hey, let's take credit for it. And so the story comes along and says, no, the Navy won the Battle of Midway. And, of course, Ernie King wanted to have him indicted for treason. So it was a little hard to get the word out on both the good and the bad that was happening in the Battle of the Atlantic. And for the first year of that conflict, we were getting our clocks cleaned.
And we're going to take a short break here. I'm going to leave people with a sense of what was going on here. Read this one passage in the book that where America found itself after they were losing this battle and could have lost the battle in the Atlantic, which could have lost World War II. And I'll just read this one paragraph and we'll take a break and come right back. Such a defeat, the Allied naval strategists realized, was unthinkable. A U-boat victory in the North Atlantic convoy runs would leave the overarching Allied strategy, Germany first, with a massive amphibious invasion of France planned for the near future, in ruins. By the spring of 1943, the long-planned operation to deploy American and Allied ground divisions to the United Kingdom was just beginning in earnest. During the first 9 months of 1942, only two U.S. Army divisions had reached the British Isles, and one of them had been dispatched to take part in the North Africa campaign. The convoy crisis of March of 1943 thus came to a critical moment in the war effort, as the United States was starting to gear up once more for the transatlantic movement of what would ultimately be a massive Allied force base in the United Kingdom. 36 U.S. infantry, armored and airborne divisions, and 4 Canadian divisions. An Allied failure to engage and destroy Germany would likely jeopardize the uneasy alliance between the West and the Soviet Union, possibly setting the stage for a separate peace between Berlin and Moscow that would mean an overall collapse of the Allied war effort. The consequences of Allied failure in the North Atlantic was unthinkable. So how did we win it? We'll come back and talk about that after this break. We are here this hour with Ed Offley, whose book is Turning the Tide, How a Small Band of Allied Sailors Defeated the U-Boats and Won the Battle of the Atlantic Sea. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are talking today with Ed Offley. His book is Turning the Tide, How a Small Band of Allied Sailors Defeated the U-Boats and Won the Battle of the Atlantic. And he's a military historian and journalist. He is a Vietnam vet. He's served in the U.S. Navy. Before we jump into some of the stories of these individuals, because what makes this book so vibrant is the stories of the men that you interviewed, the stories of the men who you learned about through their families and all your series of interviews that you did. But one of there were two battle fronts here. One was this insane, intense battle between the boats that protected the convoys and the convoys taking stuff across the seas and the German U-boats, the submarines blowing them up everywhere it turns. But the other was the war over cryptography, the war over decoding the other side's messages, Germany having the upper hand in the beginning, but the Americans and Brits coming back to take the upper hand. Tell that story.
Well, this is a war that most people did not ever hear of until the mid-70s. Beginning even before World War II broke out, the British realized that they were going to have to repeat a military intelligence success they had done in World War I, which was to be able to break the German military codes. And by doing so, you get to see the other guy's cards and you get to predict what he's going to do and have a more effective way of stopping him. This was the whole story of the Enigma and Bletchley Park and the ultra secret. Through espionage, bribery, and other historically traditional means to intelligence, the British were able to get wind of what they called the Funk Schuschel M Enigma machine.
I love that name, the Enigma machine.
The Enigma machine. It looked like a manual typewriter on steroids. And to describe it verbally would probably be impossible. So I'll just try it in a postcard. It used a very complicated, brilliantly designed sequence of movable electronic circuits so that when you type the letter E, a light would light up and it would say M. You type the letter E another time, and the letter Q would come up. And what it turned out was every letter that you encoded for, say, a message would be encoded on a different algorithm, a different process. And the linkage that kept that from getting lost was the key to being able to translate it at the other end. You set the machine up in certain ways. There were rotors. There were plugs. There was a bunch of other stuff. the number of variables was in the billions, like that the letter E would come up B or G or whatever. And the Germans were pretty proud. They thought they created a system that nobody would ever break. What would happen, say, and we'll use the U-boat as an example, you'd have this machine. The captain would write out a message saying, proceeding west at 0200, and the radioman would type it into the Enigma machine and it would come out in total gibberish. And then he would raise the aerial and using a telegraph key, like the guy on the Titanic, he would telegraph out the encryption in Morse code. It would be intercepted in Germany, but it would also be intercepted in France and England and Poland. But there they would have another Enigma machine. They set it to the same setting. They type in the garble, and out comes clear text. Well, the Brits were pretty smart. They realized that they needed to get ahead of this very early in the war, and they were able to actually, through the help of the Poles and the French, come up with a conceptual idea of what the Enigma was like. But it wasn't until 1941 that they had their really major breakthrough. They were able to capture a German U-boat. The crew had abandoned ship, and some British sailors got on board and actually seized an Enigma machine and the rotors and the other backup gear. And with that in hand, they were able, within a very short period of time, to build they were called bombs, but they were essentially very primitive computers that replicated what the Enigma did and were able to essentially take the encrypted wave of encrypted messages that would come in during a day and break most of them into clear text within hours. That way they knew where the U-boats were going, they knew where they'd been, and they knew what Admiral Doniz's plans were. Well, it didn't last forever. This was in mid-41. 7 months later, Doniz essentially changed the machine. It used to have three of these movable rotors. He added a fourth. The intelligence went black. They couldn't decrypt anything for 10 long months. And that was at the time when the Germans had their greatest successes. Meanwhile, this is something that Western historians tended not to talk about too much because it probably was still secret. And the Germans were very good at breaking our codes too. Our codes weren't as good as the Enigma, and everybody was so confident, but the Germans are very, very good too.
So, but they did break it. I mean, this is a big piece of the battle when the Americans could actually do this and knew what was going on. This helped turn the tide of this war.
Right. But unfortunately, the Brits were breaking the codes, as we previously talked about, sent a clear message saying there are six submarines coming day after tomorrow. Better do something about it. And if you don't take action on intelligence, you might as well not have it. But they did learn their lesson. By the crisis in the spring of 43, the British and the Americans had essentially broken back into Enigma. And it was like both sides were playing poker, and they were both taking peeks at what the other guy had. And sometimes it would cause all sorts of unintended consequences.
So we'll get to Winston Churchill in this meeting he had, which I really love this little piece of the book with Admiral Horton convincing Churchill that now is the time. You're either going to give us this stuff and we're going to break the back of the Germans, or you're not, we're going to lose.
This is one of the unsung heroes of World War II. Is a Britisher named Sir Max Kennedy Horton. He was one of the British Navy's first submariners. That was his career specialty. And in 1942, late 42, Churchill decided the best way to defeat the U-boats was to bring in a submariner of his own. And so he appointed Horton to run what they called the Western Approaches Command, which was the British Navy command responsible for all the North Atlantic convoys and defense in the Battle of the Atlantic. He was plagued with shortages. One of the stories that to me just as I was writing it, I was still in disbelief of what I had, discovered. There was a bomber in World War II. It was the heaviest bomber before the B-29. It was called the B-24 Liberator in terms of long range and payload. The British found out that by taking out the aft bomb bay and putting a fuel tank in there, they could get all the way out into the mid-Atlantic where no other airplane had ever been able to go. One of the great weaknesses of the convoy system from North America to the United Kingdom and back was there was about a 600 to 800 mile swath of the deep Atlantic southwest of Iceland. They called it the Greenland Air Gap. And the ships crossing that swath of ocean, it took usually between 36 and 48 hours to do so, were at the complete mercy of the U-boats because their defenses were just not strong enough at that time without aircraft overhead. Well, they found out, the British found out, okay, we put a fuel tank in the back of this plane, and it can fly out 20 hours, 20-hour flight, which means it can get down to the air gap, fly around on patrol for 6 or 7 hours, and make it all the way back to either Northern Ireland or Iceland. Well, here's one of the great things about World War II. You think people were stupid in the Cold War. Consolidated Aircraft had, by mid-43, had built 7,000 of these bombers. The convoy defenses had 18. And every time they tried to get an additional bomber, the Americans would say no. The American Army Air Forces said, we want them. The U.S. Navy wanted them, but not for that. They wanted them for the Pacific. And even the Royal Air Force wanted them, but to bomb Germany. And literally one historian, and I can't prove or disprove it, but I tend to believe it, said that if they'd only gotten like 10 more of these planes a year earlier, they would have won the Battle of the Atlantic a year earlier. But everybody was so paralyzed into doing their own little operation, and everybody kept saying, oh, the Battle of the Atlantic's okay. Somebody else can take care of the problem. Same thing with destroyers. The British throughout World War II did not have enough small warships. They lost a lot of them at Dunkirk in 1940. They lost a lot of them in the Mediterranean and up in Norway. And so when Admiral Horton, you know, asked the Navy, said, just give me some more destroyers so I can strengthen my convoy groups, everybody said, no, 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 we need them more, we need them more. And it took this incredible disaster of convoy Halifax 229 and SD-122 before people like Prime Minister Churchill realized, hey, we've got a real problem here. And one of the four or five different events that happened in a very short period of weeks that caused the shift in fortune was that Churchill finally realized he had to get some more destroyers out into the Atlantic. And it wasn't that many. It was a couple of dozen.
Amazing piece of the story, I mean, how this actually happened. But I want to one of the things that makes this book interesting beyond the military aspects of the story and how this battle was won and this kind of hidden secret linchpin to winning World War II are the people that you interviewed and the men's stories that are kind of the text throughout all this book.
Let me tell you about some of the guys I got to know. An American, John Waters.
John, the Coast Guard man.
He started out at the University of North Carolina State as a star lineman on their football team, but he read the papers and he saw that war was coming, and he decided, like many, that he was going to create his own fate. So he applied to the U.S. Coast Guard Academy and was accepted in 1940, I believe. And they graduated that class a year early because they needed to
43
get him out
instead
to the
of 44.
43 instead of 44, or 42 instead of 43. And he found himself on a beat-up little transport heading to Iceland to join his ship, which was the Coast Guard cutter Ingham, which, by the way, is a museum ship in Charleston, South Carolina today, and the National World War II memorial for the Coast Guard. The Ingham was one of six vessels that the Coast Guard had that was one of the best U-boat killers ever designed. It was the size of a small destroyer, but it was fast. It had incredibly long range. Well, he gets to Iceland after going through one of the worst, one of the early convoy battles, and he said it was a great experience for him because he learned what it was like to be a terrified merchant sailor or passenger, helpless to do anything and just hopelessly totally depending on some other guys in a warship to save your life. And he started out as an ensign and was involved in several of the critical convoy battles that happened in the spring of 43. But he went on. By the end of the war, he was a captain and the commander of not just a destroyer but a destroyer squadron. He got promoted fast in those days.
Coast Guard now.
Coast Guard. That's well, right. The Coast Guard was totally in the Navy at the
right,
time.
Right.
It was all mixed up. There was another guy that I really was very glad to find. His name was Martin Beisham.
The German U-boat.
German U-boat radioman. And his life story explains to me why you could have a Navy, the German U-boat force, populated by technically competent, good people who still were at the service of a monstrous regime. And he told the story very matter-of-factly because it was just the facts that had happened to him. When he was 12 years old, he was told that he'd been accepted into the Hitler Youth Movement. Now, this was a Nazi organization that had been implemented in the 20s to replace things like the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts and church youth groups. They created one youth movement in Germany, and their loyalty was to Hitler, the Führer. And there was not an element of choice. He gets to be a teenager, and he is assigned to the State Labor Service. It's got a German name I can't pronounce. And this was the Hitler Public Works Movement. Everybody not in the military or holding down a deferrable job went to work building autobahns and bridges and stuff like that. And again, the element of choice was not there. It was never an issue. You went where you were told to go. And he was groomed. He realized later he was groomed to become a radioman even before he'd ever thought of joining the Navy. They trained him in camps how to do radio. So when it came time for him to enlist, he already knew he was going to be a U-boat radioman because that's what they'd been training him for in secret. But he was of a mind that you could do your job, serve your country, and still be a decent person. And it's a very uncomfortable subject even now, eight decades after the war. How do you separate the decency of an individual from the tyranny of a regime? And they had to wrestle with it, and so do we.
His story was I found really interesting. And who do you like? I mean, then there were so many others, though. I mean, there were Commander Peter Gretton.
Oh, he's one of my favorites.
He's a pivotal character in the book.
I have to tell you, I enjoyed dealing with the Brits because as a quirk of my own upbringing, my father was an Air Force pilot. I spent 3 years as a teenager growing up in Bermuda, which is still a British colony. And my parents, as a gesture of multiculturalism, packed me and my two brothers off to a British high school where they had one rule: you're guilty until proven innocent. But I learned about houses and points and prefix long before Harry Potter because it was all there. But the Brits had a stoicism that I don't even know if I understand it today. It's the stiff upper lip, essentially, is what it
right.
is.
Well, my mother was a Brit. I understand it.
Okay. Well, Peter Gretton, all he wanted to do was serve in destroyers. And so the Royal Navy sent him everywhere else for a decade before that. It took World War II before they finally said, okay, you can go into that kind of ship. And he distinguished himself very much. He ended up commanding four different warships over a three-year period, mostly because they got so beat up they had to just decommission them for repairs and get a new guy in. But he told a harrowing experience and such understatement that it just made me roll my eyes. He was up on deck one day supervising some sailors who were trying to lash down a lifeboat that had come loose. And he turned his back to the ocean, and at that moment a wave came over, washed four of them over the side. You know, you think of like falling off a high diving board. He found himself falling, splash, ice cold. He opened his mouth to shout, and before he could even do that, another wave picked him up and dropped him back on the ship, where he lay stunned for a few seconds before somebody grabbed him. Well, he stumbled forward to the bridge to report to his captain. He was not the captain then. What had happened, and he was berated for leaving the ship without permission.
Typical British story.
The Brits.
But one of the things that I think these stories do, I mean, is how they humanize what people went through.
And they went through a lot. Oh, my God.
I mean, going back to Dean Wynn, when he had to abandon ship and then had to climb the ladder to safety and when they rescued him. And his mates didn't make it. I mean, this book is filled with those kind of stories.
Oh, the one that broke my heart, and I don't know if I think this has been mentioned in one book, previously, but I found his widow. There were two brothers named Stalinovich.
Oh, Stalinovich brothers, right.
From Hibbings, Minnesota, the home place of
Bob Dylan. Right.
And they were like two of like five sons, but they joined the Navy on the same day, served in the same boot camp company, and both entered a very new outfit called the Naval Armed Guard. Now, this is one of the offshoots of World War II that received very little publicity. The Navy armed merchant ships. They took these old World War I cannons, bolted them to the deck, and then would assign anywhere from 12 to 40 actual U.S. Navy sailors on board as gunner's mates to help shoot against U-boats and aircraft if the need came up. Well, they both ended up in the Atlantic, Naval Armed Guard Atlantic, and they both ended up in Convoy Halifax 229. Now, this convoy left the first week of March and was involved in, as I say, that really bloody defeat out in the mid-Atlantic on St. Patrick's Day, March 16th. Well, Bill Stalinovich was on a ship called the Irénée DuPont freighter, and his brother was like two ships over in a ship called the Harry Luckenbach. And the night before the battle started, one of the brothers managed to convince a signalman to send a blinking light message to the other ship saying, Hey, Harry, or I'm Harry, good luck. Hope we make it through the battle. Mm-hmm. Well, about 8 hours later, Bill Stalinovich is on deck, and he's in the other ship, his brother, is on. It doesn't just get torpedoed in the sink. It gets torpedoed, and the entire ship fireballs. It was carrying a lot of ammunition. As it turned out, from later eyewitness accounts, several lifeboats were able to get away with a number of crewmen in them, but in the confusion and chaos of battle, the escorts, there were very few in this group, lost track of the lifeboats, and they were never seen again. So everybody on that ship died. And a day or two later, Bill Stalinovich realized that the chances his brother had survived were practically zero. Well, except his ship then gets sunk, and he's clinging to a lifeboat for, I guess, 8 or 10 hours before he gets rescued. So they get to England, and he's recovering in the hospital. And this Navy officer comes up to him and says, "You need to know one thing. You're going to go home on emergency leave, but you cannot discuss anything about your brother and his ship with anyone, including your family." There was still no confirmation. It was still listed as possibly missing, although everybody knew everybody on that ship had gone down. So this poor guy had to cross the Atlantic, take a train back to Minnesota, and spend 2 weeks with his family, where his mother was saying, "Well, where's your brother? I don't know." And it just ate him alive. And it wasn't until a month later that the telegram finally arrived at the family house.
Talk about, I mean, given all this and that this battle, as we talk about turning the tide, this Battle of the Atlantic, how it turned World War II around. Great, well-written book, great stories, powerful stuff. But why should we care now, 80 years later?
I came up with, I thought, a pretty good answer to myself when I was trying to write a proposal to my publisher saying, why don't we do this book? I think there's some things that should not be forgotten. I think there's some experiences that our country has that should very much be remembered. I mean, we remember the Maine. We remember Pearl Harbor. I think we ought to remember the Battle of the Atlantic, not just because it was such an amazing event and full of human drama, but it showed that, to me, what happened, there's a thing called the myth of the inevitability of history. This thing could have gone either way, I think. And we're very lucky that it went the way it did. I think it's very incumbent upon everyone who is interested in their country and in its history to realize these things and study these things, not just to be like a Hallmark card memorial service, but to understand that the world is full of some very vicious currents. We've been through a couple in the last decade that we can talk about now. One of the things on a completely different level that amazes me is that the whole issue of confronting a threat at sea is something that people really forget quite easily. I'm going to lay it out as quickly as I can. The British invented and refined the convoy system in the 1700s, 1600s, when they had sailing ships, because there were pirates and there were enemies, other empires. And they defeated Napoleon and then went through 100 years of peace. And so what happened was all the admirals retired and died. New ones came in. Lessons unlearned. When World War I broke out and both sides were building submarines as fast as they could, nobody thought that, hey, maybe we'd better look back on convoying as a way to protect our shipping. And if it's a different subject or a different chronology, but World War I, they suffered horrific losses to a much more primitive U-boat force. Well, this time around, 1939 comes along. Churchill was smart enough and had served in the Admiralty in World War I that they had a convoy plan ready that they executed the first day of the war. But for some reason, the U.S. Navy either didn't get it, overlooked it, or ignored it. And I'm afraid it's the latter, that they just ignored it. It took the Atlantic Fleet 4 months, 4.5 months after these attacks started on the East Coast, before somebody got around to saying, hey, you know, maybe we better turn the lights off in the harbors and maybe we better instigate a convoy system. And during that time, the Germans call it the happy time, they were shooting freighters and tankers miles off the coast like ducks in a barrel.
And you still think this is relevant for today?
Yes. There are these idiots out in Somalia with a little fast boats and a couple of AK-47s for somehow reason that I didn't understand until my research into my book, and then I understood it, are able to thwart an international naval force that now numbers about 40 warships on any given day in that region. They have learned to neutralize warships armed with helicopters and lasers and night vision goggles and satellites simply by dispersing across in a huge area of ocean. This is what the U-boats did. I studied in preparation for the publication of this book. I spent a good 3 weeks studying everything that's happened in the last 2 years in terms of the Somali piracy. And I've read transcripts and speeches and testimony and position papers from the Pentagon and from the NATO command and from the European Union, which has its own little force out there. And the one word that has been absent throughout what is now several years of steadily increasing pirate attacks is the word convoy.
Mm-hmm.
Ships go whenever they want, wherever they want. A pirate mothership attacks them. They go, help, help. I don't care how fast your helicopter is. If you're 500 miles away, by the time you get there, it's too late. If they set up a convoy system, it would have two routes, from the Gulf of Aden to Mumbai, India, from the Gulf of Aden to South Africa. You put all those ships together with one or two destroyers, put a couple of helicopters on them with SEALs or Brits, commandos. You got radar. You got night vision. What you do is, it's a very simple concept. If you have all the ships out there like little atoms just streaming around, the pirates can get to choose who to attack. But if you put them in a convoy and surround it by a defense, you force them to come to you where you hold the advantage. Nobody seems to have thought of it.
Ed Offaly, this has been a great, great hour, and I really enjoyed this book a great deal. Turning the Tide, How a Small Band of Allied Sailors Defeated the U-Boats and Won the Battle of Atlantic. Ed Offaly. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.